Welcome back to Season 9 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm managing just over $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and individual investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. This week, we have a special episode focused on global energy transition efforts. Maude Texier, the Global Director of Clean Energy and Decarbonization Solutions at Google, recently spoke at our investor symposium. Maude is truly an expert in this area, having previously been the head of industrial energy products at Tesla, and before that was part of working on innovative technology for Electricité de France. Maude has a Master's of Engineering in Energy and Power Systems from École Centrale Paris. Leading our discussion with Maude is HPS Managing Director Hugh Lawson. So now, let me turn it over to Hugh.
Maude, welcome. Thank you so much for coming all the way from Paris to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're excited to have the conversation about how bold leaps in energy transition are being unlocked. And you're a great person to have this conversation with, as you've been a leader in energy innovation throughout your career. And your current responsibility is quite significant. Google has set an ambitious goal to run exclusively on carbon-free energy by 2030, just in 7 years. So we'd like to explore today how you plan on doing that. And what's interesting, I think, is the broader trends around that that provide interesting investment opportunities. But before we start, let me set a little context. And it's interesting, last year McKinsey published a very long report. It's about 200 pages. And they said that the transition is going to have a few attributes. First of all, it needs to be universal, so it touches every sector. It needs to be significant in that something like $6.5 trillion per annum will need to be invested in renewables and the infrastructure around it. And it's rich in opportunity, of course, because there will be processes and products that are decarbonized along the way. But of the $6.5 trillion, which is an annual number again, only a fraction of it will come from public sources. The IRA in the United States and other legislation is slated at something like a $1.3 trillion subsidy over a decade. So we'll call that $130 billion a year, which is significant, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to the U.S. share of the $6.5 trillion. And by the way, that's on top of the $2 trillion that will continue to need to be invested in carbon-based energy during the transition. So these are really big numbers. So what's interesting is the private sector is going to be the source of the bulk of the capital. And in this, Google is a leader. And I want to start with the pledge. So the pledge is carbon-free energy by 2030, and you call it for short the 24/7 program. It's more ambitious than the 2050 net zero target in the Paris Agreement. So you probably could have set for 2050, but you did 2030. And it's more notable given that the world's demand for energy is projected to rise at least two or three times. Some have even said five times. Google itself uses something like three times more electricity than major cities like San Francisco per year. And with AI, I can only imagine how much electricity you'll need by 2030. So Maude, could you share the scale of the 24/7 program and kind of your starting point with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe before digging into the program itself, let me start with a bit of context and history about where Google is coming from. As you mentioned, we're a large energy user. If you look at our historical load growth, we are increasing our electricity consumption around 10 to 20% year over year. So this has been a steep curve for us. And so that's why almost two decades ago, when Google started thinking about their sustainability and carbon footprint, very quickly we zeroed in on the electricity consumption of the data centers, because we realized this was the backbone of the internet, and that was one of the core sectors where our carbon footprint was coming from. So this is what started our journey around 2010, around clean energy and how do we decarbonize the grids where we are operating. And we really started in 2011 and 12 looking for clean electricity that could power our data centers. But we realized quickly it was not that easy and actually was quite complex for an energy buyer like us to access clean electricity. Let me explain to you a little bit how grids work if you're not familiar with that. You can imagine a grid as a large pool where you have all the electrons. And so you have a power plant generating electrons, dropping them into this pool, and on the other side you have Google as a buyer getting electrons. you cannot really trace those electrons, where they're coming from and where they're going. So now Google, as a user, we're looking at this pool and we're looking for the clean electrons, and we realized it was impossible for us to do that. And so we went the other side and we found a wind farm in the Midwest of the US. This was our first clean energy projects, and we signed a long-term contract with this wind farm, something that you call PPAs, Power Purchase Agreement. What PPAs are is generally you have a corporate buyer like Google who is going to come and sign an offtake contract for all the generation of this wind farm. And this is going to be a long tenure contract with a fixed price. So something very, very easy for the wind farm to take on, and something that a corporate buyer can de-risk from our perspective. So we went on for this with this first project in 2010, 2011. And then onwards, we started working into growing this portfolio with the objectives to gather enough clean electricity globally to match our annual electricity consumption of all our data centers across the world. And this is how we ended up today with a very large renewable energy portfolio under contract management. So just to give you a range of the magnitude, we have around 80 projects globally that we are managing and 10 gigawatts of wind and solar across 5 different continents.
Wow. So 10 gigawatts, which is a lot, across 80 different projects. So let me make sure I understand. So somewhere along that journey in 2017, I believe it was, you pledged to purchase as much renewable energy as you used, but that has a fungibility problem. So it sounds like you were purchasing a lot of renewables in markets that had a lot of renewables, but in other markets that didn't, you couldn't, right? But you were over-purchasing in some markets to basically subsidize. I think what you just described, and people often talk about the decentralization of the energy ecosystem, I think that's an example. So you're going to have 80 projects where you're trying to build clean energy or catalyze the building of clean energy quite proximate to the use. So you're going to generate it more or less next door to where you're using it? Is that what's different?
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned it very well. 2017 was a bit of a pivot year for us because this was the first year where we actually achieved this goal of purchasing enough clean electricity to match our energy consumptions globally. So fast forward, we achieved this for the first time in 2017 and then 18 and 19. And after 2 or 3 years, we kept growing our portfolio to match our energy consumption increase. But we started really digging into this inventory and trying to understand, are we really achieving on one side the decarbonization impact that we were looking for in the first place? And second, as our portfolio keeps growing, what does that mean from a long-term financial management perspective? One thing we realized in 2017 when we did this inventory is that actually, like you mentioned, our portfolio was a little bit imbalanced. It was imbalanced from two perspectives. First, we had a lot of renewable energy projects in specific regions. In the US, those are the regions where you have a lot of renewable energy. Texas, Midwest is an example. In Europe, Scandinavia has a lot of wind as well, so historically we had wind farms. While we were purchasing those clean energy projects, our load was growing in markets where clean energy was not that available. And so we ended up with this regional imbalance where in certain grids we were short from a clean energy supply perspective, and in other grids we were long. So that was creating two issues for us. One, we couldn't really claim that actually our data centers were running on clean electricity while we were running short. And two, this was also creating more of a financial risk exposure for us because now we had those long and short positions across different markets.
That's interesting. So I want to come back to the sort of portfolio effect, but let's spend a minute on technology. So clearly solar, wind, and to some extent battery storage have been around for a while. There are new technologies that are on the horizon. In order for you to reach your goal by 2030, how many of these new technologies need to be scaled? Is it new things or the old things that will get you there?
Yeah, great question. We just talked about, you know, the portfolio and I would say the variability of this carbon-free energy content across our portfolio before. As we said on this 24/7 objective for 2030, we started looking at all our grids where we're operating. And just to give you a sense, we're operating across 24 energy markets or power grids across the world. And we realized that those grids were very different. In some grids, we had a lot of wind and solar, but that also created some hours where we had shortage of clean electricity because the wind doesn't always blow, the sun doesn't always shine. And then we had other regions where we realized that those resources were just very limited in the first place. An example that you might have seen in our portfolio is Taiwan. We have a data center in Taiwan, but this is an islanded grid with very little real estate available on the island for clean energy. So for instance, solar or onshore wind is very limited. So as we went through this process, this is how we realized that we're going to need to expand a little bit the tools in our toolkits for clean energy and clean electricity procurement. And we started looking for what are those new technologies that would be complementary to wind and solar and really help us increase this, this ratio between our consumption and our production on a real-time basis. And so for that, we kind of like went back a little bit to first principles of the grid. So similarly, if you're not familiar with how we generate electricity on a grid, you have broadly two categories of power plant. One is a power plant that we call base load or firm generation resources. And you can imagine a coal power plant, for instance, in most of the grids today. It's always on, it's very cheap to run, and so therefore it's a continuous flow of electrons. However, it's not very flexible. And so on top of that, you need another type of power plant that you call peaker plants. And those peaker plants run only a few hours a year. They're much more expensive to run, but they're very reactive. On the very hot days, for instance, in the US or even in Europe right now, everybody's running their air conditioning. You need those bursts of electrons that normally you do not use. This is when you use peaker plants. And traditionally, those have been gas turbines, for instance. And so what we're looking for now is really clean alternatives to those traditional base load and peaker plants. And that's why we're looking for clean, firm generation resources on one side and clean peaker plants on the other side. We have narrowed down our search to mainly five technologies. Just to be clear, we're not necessarily looking at picking technology winners. This is not our Google strategy. But we narrowed down the sources based on the requirements and the specifications that we had from our own goals and portfolio. So just to give you some specific, our program is due by 2030. Mm-hmm. So we need those technologies to be ready and at scale by 2030. We also looked for technologies that had a high potential of cost curve decline based on rate of deployment. So the more you can deploy those power plants by 2030, the more the cost is going down. And then finally, we also took into account the fact that when you build a new power plant as an asset, there's still a lot of, I would say, criteria around social community integration and also environmental criteria. And again, we believe that those five technologies can bear with those criteria that we have.
Well, it's interesting, you know, as we were preparing for this, I was struck by this whole decentralization theme. So I want to unpack that a little bit because I think it's important. So it's not just simply a case where in regions where renewables are easy, you necessarily want as much of it as possible. Because, of course, you're not matching necessarily the loads in those regions with the generation, right? You might have too much. And then you have the variability problem. And so what's interesting is when you think about it, because you're using more and more electricity all over the world, and you also want computing times to be quick, right, for people to do Google searches and so forth, so the data center needs to be, you know, responsive and close to the market, you fundamentally need to restructure the energy ecosystem basically as a business matter, because it sounds like you're reducing vol around both the price and availability of electricity, you're heightening security, and of course, you're decarbonizing. Is that a fair way to characterize what you're trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us, one of the key enablers on why Google took that to that target in the first place is it was really going beyond the traditional corporate ESG programs and perspective. Today, you know, corporate clean energy procurements is mainly to drive carbon metrics, decarbonization, or greenhouse gas emissions reductions. Our approach to 24/7, we realized very quickly, created a lot of business values from different perspectives. One, as you mentioned, around energy price volatility and hedging, and we can talk more about that, but really having a clean energy portfolio with a fixed price on one side that is completely hedging your consumption on the same grid on the other side, especially in the current, you know, environment we've seen last winter in Europe, for instance, has been bringing a lot of value for us. Mm-hmm. And then separately to your point as well with AI and even before that with our cloud business, we had a massive growth, but a growth that was a little bit different from what we had historically, because historically for search and YouTube, you just want a big data center in one place and run all your queries. with cloud and all those new usage, we need to be much closer to the customers. And that's why we have this decentralization a little bit of our data center portfolio. And from there, we really need to tackle new markets and new countries. And with that, there comes new needs for us. For instance, when we build a new data centers, we need to make sure that we have net new electrons, right, coming from that grid for our data centers. So this is not even about how clean those electrons are, is we just need those electrons to appear. And also we are noticing in certain regions what I would call the more and more pressure around social license to operate for us and other industries. As we want to bring more data centers and factories at the local side, we are required to bring a social and a climate plan and making sure that we are fully integrated in the local infrastructure. And this is where 24/7 really carries as a story and an impact, because again, this is a local program for us that we are running.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, you know, in terms of the capital that needs to move, you want electricity where you need it. You might as well do it in a renewable format because that's actually cost effective and more efficient. And it's core to the business, which I think is really interesting. So maybe let's turn to some of those projects a little bit and how you source them. A lot of what you describe in sort of a decentralized way is creating investment opportunities, because what it doesn't sound like it is giant utility systems expanding what they're doing. What you're talking about are projects all over. So who are some of the actors? These are developers, these are private sector people outside of the utility. Who's involved, and what sort of investment opportunities in general does this create?
Great question. And before getting there, I should flag that, again, we are operating on roughly 24 grids today. And you can imagine that you have 24 very different markets to deal with. Every grid is slightly different, and that's one of the key complexity, I would say, for the energy industry to deploy globally, is the local regulations and market mechanisms are always very different. And so for us, what this means in terms of portfolio engagement is we're going to work with very different stakeholders across the globe. Certain markets, we're going to be able to work directly with the local utility, develop with them tariff, build together power plants, and really a tighter engagement. Some other markets, we're going to go work with independent power producers or renewable energy developers. And this is a very fragmented market in general, but we've seen a lot of growth, especially in the diversity of offering on that side in the US and in Europe more recently.
Right. Is the value chain too disaggregated to get there efficiently and quickly? Because you're going to have to build a lot of these things at once. Can you talk to us about that?
So this is definitely not a quick process. Just to give you an order of magnitude, from the time when we sign a contract with a renewable energy developer to the time where we receive the electrons for the first time, there's at least a 3-year lag. And so, for instance, what the team is working on today is already looking at what we need for 2026 and 2027. And this lag is partially because this is infrastructure and it takes time to build things, but also because this is a very linear and sequential process. And just to give you a couple of examples around where the pain points are across this process is, broadly, you can think about developing and building a clean energy power plant as two types of activities. The first one is what I call development and deployment of the projects. And the second one is going to be about commercial and financing of the projects. Deployment and development starts more traditionally like real estate infrastructure. You need to find the sites, you need to lease or acquire the site. Where the difficulty comes, especially around clean energy projects, and more recently, particularly in the US, is it's very hard for developers to understand which sites are going to be the best to integrate with the local grid. So what I mean by that is if you build a wind farm, you're going to connect it to the local grid. You need to make sure that grid is sized to receive your electrons. You need to make sure that you have poles and wires available to host those electrons. And so there's a whole study that has to go through with the utility partner and the grid partner. That's why we call it interconnection. And this interconnection phase has been a big blocker in the US more recently. A very specific example is one of the large operating energy market regions in the US, which goes all the way from Illinois to Virginia, so really a large region. Over there, the grid operator has received a massive influx of renewable energy projects requests for interconnection. And on top of that, those are new types of technologies, so they're not used to studying those technologies very quickly. Mm. And so with that, the grid operator got completely overwhelmed, and they had to put on pause all the treatment of those new requests. So basically, the whole clean energy development market has been stalled and is going to be stalled for a couple of years. So just here, you see how you get a lot of flags on how the grid and the stakeholders are learning about using those clean energy power plants and how they can really integrate them into the system. So that's for the more technical side. For the commercial and financing part, there's also many steps, right? I mentioned earlier we are signing PPAs, power purchase agreement, and I have to say this has been a kind of a major game changer for wind and solar projects, because you have to imagine those grids when you push electrons, there's an energy market layer on top of that, right? A financial layer on how you get paid for your production and how you pay for your consumption of those electrons. Every minute, really, you need to have this balance between demand and supply on these energy markets, and from there you're going to get a resulting price. Mm-hmm. Wind and solar is very challenging because they are intermittent by nature, and it's very hard to predict actually when they're going to be producing or stop producing. So from a price volatility, this is a lot of risk. Again, as a developer, you go try to get financing out of these projects. Your cash flow is not predictable at all, mm-hmm. so it's very hard to get financing. And that's where things like our new transaction instruments like PPAs have been very helpful, because now you have those fixed-term contracts with much more predictable revenues. And so PPAs have been a core mechanism to really, I would say, boost those markets over the past 10 years. Just to give you a sense, the number of corporate PPAs that have been signed last year is 10 times bigger than what we used to sign 6 years ago globally across all the corporates. So this is really a booming industry, and it keeps rising as well. But again, while we succeeded in doing that for wind and solar, mm-hmm. we need to start thinking about how do we do that for this next generation of technologies we talked about earlier. What is a green hydrogen PPA? How do you define a green hydrogen project? Who takes the technology risk? Because those are still new technologies. And on top of that, you have market risk. And I think this is where corporate buyers have been doing a good job in the past, and we need to do more for those new technologies. But there's also a dialogue that can happen with financing and investors, and really connecting together on what does a bankable commercial contract means for them to be able to back those projects for us.
Yeah. I want to pivot just to come back to government policy a little bit. So, you know, many have heard about the Inflation Reduction Act. I referred to it earlier. It's a pretty massive subsidy to stimulate the creation of clean energy in the United States. But it also has provisions that require domestic content. So a lot of the components have to be manufactured in the United States. And we're actually, by the way, seeing a tremendous amount of opportunity of people wanting to build factories and create jobs and generate these parts. But how important has the IRA been to Google's procurement?
The IRA has been a big accelerator for us, especially as we think about this next generation of type of assets and technologies. When we started the program in 2019, 2020, and we were asking around for, do you have green hydrogen or long duration energy batteries? It was very hard for us to get any tangible projects. And people were very worried around economics and is it really going to be a strong market signals? And we're kind of like a little bit lonely, I would say, over there looking for projects. With the IRA, this has been a massive game changer because there's been such stimulus around those new technologies, and there's been a big push in also creating hubs. So for instance, in the US, you might hear about carbon capture hubs or green hydrogen hubs and really helping with those economies of scale. So today for us, it helped a lot finding the supply and the projects that we need to find by 2030. Even though, you know, the infrastructure investment piece of that is present today, one of the key feedback that we're hearing from a lot of those projects is they still need the commercial off-takers on the other side. And one challenge that we have as Google, for instance, is even though we're big, we're still not going to take off a 1 gigawatt green hydrogen power plant by itself. So this is where you need to create this market demand and market signal. And how can you aggregate? How can you partner with other industrials, for instance, to create this market signal?
Interesting. Okay. Well, let me pivot to AI for a second. It's on everybody's mind. The implications are pretty extraordinary. AI computations apparently are doubling every 6 months. And training these models uses a growing share of electricity. It's an extraordinary amount. You know, as it gets applied to more and more real-world situations, how much electricity do you think you're going to need, and is the world going to need to adapt to an AI world? Well, just give us a sense of the quantum.
Yeah, this is an answer I would love to have. I think we're just at an early stage of the cycle, right, for AI. On one side, there's a lot of discussions, there's a lot of curiosity and activity. So we do see a spike in usage, that's for sure. And, you know, long term, we do see a demand, a growth stemming from AI. But on the other side, we also start seeing much more efficiency on more traditional compute and services that we've been providing to cloud customers, for instance. Now that you have AI, you do not need so much traditional compute or storage to run the same queries. There's a little bit of a cannibalization almost of the usage on certain side. So that's why it's hard for us to really know how steep the curve is going to be. The curve is going up, but again, if you look historically, our curve has been going up for the past 10 years, you know, at a rate of like 15-20% year over year. So this is not necessarily a new challenge for us, but I think it is an interesting one. And the one thing I would go even a little bit further is AI is stemming a lot of focus around electricity consumption of heavy electricity users. Mm. And I think that's a very important dialogue because data centers are only one out of many industrial players who are going to face something like an AI growth over the next decade or two decades. We are talking to a lot of more traditional heavy industrial players like chemicals, and they all have net zero targets. They all need to decarbonize. And when you look at the very first step on how do you decarbonize a business like that, it's all about electrifying your processes and manufacturing process. And so right here, this is also a lot of net new electrons that they're going to need. On top of that, we talked about them already, but we see this new wave of climate technologies that are going to come in for the energy transition or just decarbonization of the sectors. All those climate technologies, they need to be manufactured. And so you see a lot of factories being built, bigger factories for batteries or other types of components. We talked about green hydrogen. You need electrolyzers, big machines running out of clean electricity to actually produce the hydrogen. So this is really the bigger problem, which is there's a grid today and there's a lot of focus on decarbonizing that grid. But from my perspective, it's really more around what is the grid in the next decade or so that we need to build and how do we make sure that it is clean and cost efficient and reliable in the first place. This is about the next power plants that we need to bring to the grids over the next 10 and 15 years. And this is where we have the real challenge in terms of scale and pace of deployment.
Interesting. Well, I do want to pick up one thing you said on it. So AI uses electricity, but it also helps people save it.
Correct.
It's an efficiency. How do you apply AI now, for example, to use less electricity?
Yes, great question. So on one side, AI is going to be a vector for us to focus to make sure that, you know, we keep decarbonizing our operations despite the business growth. On the other side, it is an opportunity to develop new solutions for climate change. So just to give you a couple of examples on, again, in the context of energy and power markets and grids, how you can use AI. Personally, on our side, we've been using AI for our own operations. In the past, we've tested using AI to optimize how we are managing data centers and energy and thermal management system, and we created a lot of energy efficiency within our data centers. And keep in mind, energy efficiency is very interesting because on one side, it helps you decarbonize, but on the other side, it helps you save money as a business. And so those are really strong vectors for us. The second item I would mention is a little bit more broadly, which is we talked about clean energy, we talked about how we need to better match our consumption and production in real time. This is really less about AI, but more broadly around digitalization of the grids. Mm. And as much as we need to deploy and build net new infrastructure, if this infrastructure doesn't have real-time controls or real-time data reporting, we're not going to be smart about utilizing those infrastructures. We need to be very efficient about utilizing those infrastructures. And that's where modernizing the grids around data, which data are available, how do you use those data in terms of predictions? We talked a lot about wind and solar and how intermittent they are. Can you predict, can you forecast when wind is going to blow and therefore when you do not need other power plants versus when the wind is going to stop and you need a battery to help you procure the missing electrons during that time? So this is where AI is really entering, I would say, a real opportunity for us. But you still need this data layer in the first place. You need all those data to be able to run AI.
One of the other things that Google has been very vocal about is that your objective is not only to decarbonize yourself, but it's to act as a catalyst to sort of help others do the same thing. Can you give us an example or two of how you're collaborating with others?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of pathways for this catalytic role. One, we're trying to de-risk technologies, right? By having Google signing a project with a new technology, we believe that it helps create a lot of credibility to those technologies. And also, we're trying to be very transparent about the results there as well. So being a little bit of a technology risk taker for us is one way to be catalytic. An example is we actually have a project in Nevada, an advanced geothermal project that is about to be commissioned and starting operations pretty soon. But back then, it's 3 years ago, when we signed this project about advanced geothermal, it was very early on for this industry. And today, there's much more activity in the U.S. around geothermal. So just as an example. Second example is that we also realized that, you know, very selfishly, if we're the only ones asking for those type of products in the market, it's going to be a high premium because it's going to be custom. So actually, the more people we have embarking on that journey with us, the easier it's going to be for us. So it's kind of this virtuous cycle for us. So we have been working a lot with partners across the energy value chain. You can think about utilities, energy suppliers, and we've been working a lot with them to create new contract structures and commercialization pathways to reduce the complexity for the buyers to be able to replicate the same thing.
Yeah. Well, we could go on and on and on. And I've learned so much from spending a little time together, Maud. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Maud Texier and to Google for letting us share this insightful conversation on the pod. And thanks to my colleague, Hugh Lawson, for leading the discussion. Check out our show notes to learn more about Maud and her work at Google. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.